Hey, Mark, I was listening to Paramore the other day, and it really made me think about the amygdala and the limbic system.
You just made those words up, didn't you?
What, Paramore?
We're the Nevermind the Music podcast, where one musician
and one psychologist
talk songwriting and the mind, one song at a time.
We'll hear everything from Green Day and Outkast
to Stevie Wonder and Dua Lipa.
And we mostly try to stay on topic.
Except for when we don't want to.
Nevermind the Music, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Star Wars Film Festival. We're the Lorehounds, your guides to a galaxy far, far away. I'm David.
I'm John, and this is our continuing coverage of the 2016 film Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, this time featuring an interview with Lieutenant Colonel, retired, Matthew L. Kavanaugh, PhD.
So we've been covering all of the Star Wars movies in story order. The next up is going to be A New Hope, but we have this little segue here to talk with Matt about the military and its relationship. Well, I guess, I don't know, John, how do we want to explain this? The fact that, you know, the Star Wars world is dominated by military stuff. So we thought we'd actually talk to a real military historian teacher.
Yeah, it was a really cool interview. We pre-recorded the interview, and we're now in the future recording this intro.
Right.
And I had a really great time. I learned a lot about sort of the intersection between Star Wars military culture and the real world military culture. And we talked a lot about the cost of war. We talked a lot about, you know, the way that you get together a coalition like the Rebels versus a coalition that I wouldn't even call it a coalition, you know, a banality of evil bureaucracy like the Empire. Really, really fascinating topics. I think hopefully he'll be a recurring guest because he is a very smart guy.
Yeah, he's written two books. He was the lead author, I should say, for a book called Strategy Strikes Back, How Star Wars Explains Modern Military Conflict. And then a second follow-up book, Winning Westeros, How Game of Thrones Explains Modern Military Conflict. I heard Matt on the Electric Bookaloo podcast with Anthony. If you have not heard that podcast, it's a great interview. Matt talks about the same sort of stuff, but in the Westerosian world. So it was really amazing. Since we're carrying on with the Star Wars Film Festival, and we've got Bad Batch coming up as well by the time we get this out on the air. If you have any Star Wars related feedback to send us, you can send it to starwars@thelorehounds.com, or you can visit us at our website and use the contact form or the voicemail feature there. We've also got a Discord, so you can join us in conversation there. All those links are in the show notes.
Don't forget, as always, stick around to the end of the podcast for programming notes about all the other podcasts we have coming and for a reminder about our Patreon, where you can get everything ad-free, early, bonus stuff. You got everything. And David's True Detective Detective's Notebook is one of those things. We got to always plug that.
Yeah.
So anyway, David, think we should get to the conversation, because let's not keep the people waiting for greatness.
Absolutely. Matt, thanks for joining us. Really excited to have you on. I heard you on Anthony's podcast, and I was just really taken with the conversation that you and he had. The insights were fascinating, and it just brought a whole new understanding to the world. And I thought, oh, well, if he's done some Star Wars stuff, we've got to have him over on our podcast right away to talk about it. Because the Star Wars universe is dominated by military culture, military thought, action, you know, all these kinds of things. And so I was just really excited that you agreed to hop on. So yeah, thanks for being here.
Yeah, I'm super excited. I just retired from 25 years in the Army.
Wow, and, congratulations.
Thank you so much. And it's good to be out, but also it's good to, you know, to be able to sort of translate how it is that those of us with short haircuts think about the world.
I was going to say, you know, your facial hair is non-regulation,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, not even close. You know, it's funny. No. I joined the Army when I was 18 years old. And so I quite literally had never had a beard in my whole life. And this is the first time. And frankly, it's awesome in the sense that, you know, scraping sharp metal on your face every day. Always the best thing, probably. So yeah. I'm really, really happy to be wearing a little face hair. So
welcome to the club. Yeah, for sure. So yeah, you were just saying Rogue One, your interest, because we're going to use Rogue One as our entry point into this idea that the Star Wars universe is dominated by military themes, concepts, what our characters are motivated by, how they respond to things, why they're even doing a whole bunch of this stuff, and whether you're Rebellion or Empire or, you know, some other faction, conflict and warfare are central to the Star Wars property. So you were just saying that Star Wars Rogue One was a film of particular interest for you.
Yeah. Let's start with, you know, two things. It's important to keep two thoughts in mind at once, right? Yes, this is a Hollywood movie. It's meant to put butts in seats. It's a space opera. It's entertainment. But at the same time, of all the Star Wars films, this is the one where we see the idea that underpins all war throughout time, which is that we trade human lives, we trade people and their lives to advance a particular cause. Right. And you know, and at the very base of that, you're asking this all important question: what is the value of the object that we seek? And in turn, what's the price that we're willing to pay to achieve it? And, you know, like in the film and in several of the films, you know, what wouldn't you sacrifice to destroy a Death Star, something that can, that's a planet killer that snuffs out lives, millions and millions of lives instantly. So, I should probably back up just a tiny bit. I mentioned I retired after 25 years in the Army, but where I really came to this idea that you could use Star Wars as a bridge to talk about bigger issues in military strategy and national security was a basic one. I was teaching at West Point, and I was in my mid to late 30s, standing in front of rooms of 18, 19, 21-year-old kids. And just that time gap, right? Like my jokes don't land. They don't even, I fought in the Iraq War. They don't know anything about that conflict because they were like, you know, still in diapers, that sort of thing.
Right.
And you know, what I realized is how important it is as a military professor, you know, teaching at West Point, to be able to have a common framework, for people to connect across. And it doesn't just work, for cadets in a classroom. It works. When I left that assignment, I did an assignment in Korea. Mm-hmm. And while Korean military officers don't know a whole lot about the American Civil War, they've all seen all of the Star Wars films.
Okay.
And, you know, civilians, when I'm trying to communicate with, civilians who do have a part to play in modern war, in the sense that you are voting for national elected leaders, you are paying taxes.
You're funding the war machine. Yeah,
exactly right. And so I feel like it's really important to be able to stand on that common ground, with anybody. And Star Wars is as good as it gets, because just, you know, even people that don't know anything know who Yoda is, right? Like, right. I mean, at the very base, it's almost like it's one of the last pop culture platforms that really has touched everybody.
Yeah, it spans across multiple generations. The choigenic nature of it, we have friends who have kids, or even our daughter, never seen an episode of Star Wars, never seen a glimpse of Star Wars, but knows Baby Yoda, knows all this stuff about it. And it's just there. It transcends. And I think that's something that John and I have discovered while doing this podcasting thing, which we sort of stumbled into, that the world of fiction can, the transition zone between fiction and real life. And when you step over into the secondary world and you look back at the real world, you can learn so much about our real world that you can't see when you're standing in the real world. Yeah, it illuminates our perspective in ways that are profound and moving at times and really can motivate action or make us feel something or make us connect to something. And so I think that is when I heard you and Anthony talking about the Westeros universe. I was like, that was a complete light bulb moment for me. It was like, yes, here is even a more practical explanation, you know, connectivity to real world issues this guy is talking about. We definitely have to talk to him. And I'll just plug really quick. You've got two books that you were lead author on. Winning Westeros, How the Game of Thrones Explains Modern Military Conflict, and Strategy Strikes Back, How Star Wars Explains Modern Military Conflict. And you've got a number of authors, and you wrote, it looks like you wrote Star Wars first and then Westeros.
Yeah.
And then those are available at popular booksellers. I found them on the Big River site and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So, John, I feel like I'm going to dominate the conversation, so maybe you should jump in with a question here.
Yeah, you know, I think, first of all, you brought up a really cool thing, which is, you know, speculative fiction, I think, in particular, is something where we are able to let go of some of the emotional baggage of things that we know about the real world and see things from different perspectives without having to confront ourselves being, I guess, wrong in our ideology right away. Do you find that that is, you know, part of your use of Star Wars and Westeros in examining military conflict?
So the best encapsulation, and I can't remember the writer, but when he was talking about the value of science fiction and fiction more broadly in national security, it's that fiction isn't an escape from reality, but it animates reality. It breathes life into and gives you the ability to enter into someone else's mind in order to use the imagination as a training ground, so to speak. So one of our co-writers from both of those book projects you mentioned, David, was Max Brooks, who wrote World War Z. And I have to tell you, you know, in the years before the pandemic, that story, I mean, I get it. And what they did in the movie was quite dissimilar from what the book actually might have looked like, but it gave you a sense for what a truly devastating global pandemic might look like, and in turn, what might sorts of things might you have to do differently in order to contest it in the national security space. You can sort of apply that in every different direction. You know, so I think fiction is that mental playground where you can entertain unthinkable thoughts and then contest those unthinkable thoughts. And, you know, I mean, the cool thing about, in particular, Rogue One is that you have all these little sidebars or footnotes or jumping off points from the storyline that you can use to sort of put an exclamation point on things in the real world.
I think it's a perfect segue into the Rogue One story and to start to talk about the wider Star Wars thing. I assume you've seen Andor as well.
Oh, yeah.
The television series. And I think what you led off with was this idea that what are you willing to sacrifice? And that, and what are you willing to trade in terms of lives, material, you know, blood and treasure for your strategic objective? And there's the trailer. I don't know how much you know about the production of Rogue One, but it went through a little bit of difficulties. They brought in Tony Gilroy to do some directing on it, or to, you know, clean it up a little bit, because the original, they weren't happy with the original cut of it. And there's a trailer, the very first trailer, there's a whole bunch of voiceover with Forrest Whitaker's character, Saw Gerrera, right? Who is this, as we know, whacked out guerrilla leader, right? Yeah. Who's really out there. And the trailer, the voiceover that he has is, you know, what will you do? What will you become? When basically, I'm paraphrasing here, but when you're pressed, when the enemy is pressing you, who are you going to become in the face of that violence and, you know, threat to you and everything that you believe in? And I really like the way that you framed Rogue One in terms of this trade, right? What are we willing to trade versus what, you know, what our gains are? Can you talk a little bit more about that in terms of strategic objectives and cost in Blood and Treasure.
Guerrera is a really interesting figure because
totally.
I mean, first of all, like Guerrera is this close to the word Guerra.
Yes, you know, exactly. War. War.
So, and in all the previous incarnations of the films, you know, you're portrayed as seeing the rebels as one monolith, more or less, or everybody sees the world the same way. But the reality is that war is for the highest stakes. And so even though even those that are on the same side, so to speak, will have immense disagreements about the pathway to some sort of victory or accomplishment. And you know, when you're fighting against an organization that would kill an entire planet or an entire people or an entire city, I mean, human beings are kaleidoscopes, and it would be impossible to predict how you would react. One of the sort of tools that I would employ in class, so I'm standing in front of a group of cadets at West Point, and I would ask, you know, if someone walked into the classroom right now, like just this moment, with a weapon, with a gun, whatever it might be, a hand grenade, how would you react? And I would have them scribble that down on a piece of paper. And then I would have, you know, I would ask for like a sampling of responses. And these are cadets. So they're type A and they're hero personality folks. So they're all, you know, they're all rushing the gunmen, that sort of thing. You know, and I asked them a serious question, and I didn't want any of them to respond to this. It was a rhetorical question. But if it really, really happened, are you so certain that that is exactly how you would truly react to such a horrifying moment in your life? The reality is none of us knows exactly how we would react. And if we don't know our own response to violence in the heat of a moment, then how likely is it that even the rebellion in this fictional universe would, mm-hmm. would all sort of conform to the same line of thinking? It's just not going to happen. So that's why I really loved this take on the rebellion. You know, you get to see
we have that fractured council meeting, right?
Yeah.
Right there where they can't even decide on what their objective is.
Yeah. And, you know, we keep hearing that Saw is an extremist. The challenge is, though, like, and we see his forces conduct an ambush, which, by the way, looks like an ambush right out of the Iraq War.
Okay.
But we don't really get more than that. You know, and, you know, even extremists have a logic to them. And mm-hmm. I'll hang some meat on that. What I mean by that is a little over a decade ago, there was a moment where ISIS, if you remember ISIS,
yep.
mm-hmm. Burned a Jordanian pilot alive yep, in a cage.
Yep.
Now, horrifying, disgusting, right. Shocks the conscience. Of course, that's the point. But there's more to it than just the shock value. If you are an organization that has no air force, that has no planes, your only ability to fight back against a modern air force is to strike fear into the heart and mind of the next pilot that gets into the next plane. And so I wish a little bit that they had given us a little bit more why they call Saw Gerrera an extremist.
Right.
But at the same time, I under, you know, realistically speaking, it would be sort of, a reasonable reaction to, you know, to the empire that kills whole planets in a single fight, you know, a single shot.
Yeah. Right.
You know, being an extremist would probably be a reasonable reaction.
Yeah. Some of the first looks of Rogue One before it went through rewrites and reshoots did show Rebel X-Wing pilots in custody being escorted by Empire troops. And then that whole segment was dropped. We do see the crashed X-Wing at one point, but I believe the Disney studio executives got a little cold feet, because it's one thing to shoot a green beam at a planet and whoop, by a billion of people. Yeah. It's another thing to see prisoners of war in that raw state. And so far our Star Wars has been very clean. It hasn't as been as gritty. And so even this was an extension of that. I think John wanted to follow up on something.
Yeah, I just wanted to talk about, you know, you brought it up yourself, but these different factions within the rebellion. And I think that's one of the most fascinating things about Rogue One. And they bring this up in the, I don't know how deep you've gone into the animated stuff, but it becomes an issue in Rebels and the Clone Wars and the Bad Batch. And just this idea of, we can't get all these people to talk to each other and come up with a common goal. And when you look at Star Wars as a full history, you look at this rebellion and how it becomes a New Republic, and they have an incredibly hard time and an unsuccessful time ultimately creating a functional military and a functional government. Can you talk about sort of how one approaches these diversities of opinion and diversities of factions when trying to, you know, do the right thing, but we can't agree on it? Because this is a common theme in real life when we can't agree on the right answer.
There's nothing harder. I mean, it take getting along with your in-laws and multiply it times a billion. Fighting in an alliance is incredibly difficult. There's that old saw, pun intended, about, you know, Churchill saying, you know, the only thing harder than fighting in an alliance is not having any allies, something to that effect. I always fall back on that. The question that I posed at the very beginning: what is the value of the object that you seek? And in turn, what is the price that you're willing to pay to achieve it? And if the value of the object is high enough, there's nearly nothing you won't do. And, you know, the Second World War, the United States allied itself with Uncle Joe Stalin. You know, we made peace with Stalin, who starved the Ukrainians, you know, a decade before the war, conducted purges of the top ranks of his general officers and his senior military command. I mean, he was not a wonderful guy, but when you're fighting the Nazis, you are necessarily getting into bed with and holding hands with pretty much anyone that you could. So I understand that. I mean, I take that point, and I expand the idea into the modern world, but also into the fictional universe. You know, we don't really get to see it. You know, there's never a point, because there's obviously in Rogue One, there's animosity between the rebellion and Saw Gerrera's forces, such that, you know, they're basically looking to kill him. But there is a moment where, aided, of course, by a human relationship, Saw Gerrera is willing to help transfer the information of the Death Star to an organization that he's more or less openly hostile to, right? You know, if you deem a planet killer such a threat, who wouldn't you pair with at that point? If, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Right.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we get back, we'll return to our interview with Matt. And we're back.
I want to ask about the guerrilla style tactics that the rebels used, at least on the ground. I think the Battle of Scarif, both from the space battle to the ground battle, is one of the best action sequences in modern cinema. It's certainly within the Star Wars universe. It was really compelling. It was really well edited and stuff. But this idea that they're just falling forward. I mean, there's the old joke about no good plan survives contact with the enemy. Yep. Right. You know, the moment things go apart. And I really like the way that Jyn Erso is like, we're just going to keep falling forward. You know, we're going to take the next chance and the next chance after that and keep hoping. What is your sense having, you know, led, having been in battle and been within that culture, how did that whole ground fight on Scarif strike you?
It looked just like the ambush scene in Jeddah City.
Okay.
Was straight out of the Iraq War. I mean, on some level, there are some things that are immaterial as to time.
Mm-hmm.
Cover and concealment matters. And
surprise. Absolutely. The
Earth's surface is naturally a complex structure, and other planets are also naturally complex. And you can utilize that as a protective shield, and you can use it to fire and maneuver. It truly was at the onset of the First World War, firepower completely overwhelmed protection. You know, if you can think of all warfare as a race between guns and armor, and in the First World War, you know, there was this moment where the guns, the munitions, the firepower so overwhelmed the ability of a defender to defend themselves. You know, you could think back to two guys fighting one sword, one shield each, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's basically equal, more or less, right? When we get to the First World War, that's done with. And so you have to find an ability to use the natural terrain to your advantage and, you know, find a way to move through that advanced firepower. And when I'm watching those scenes in Rogue One, it's the same thing. I mean, there's a colorful laser blast,
right?
But
right.
even in modern war, there's tracer fire that is meant to be used to aim onto your target. Right. And so we really are watching something that's, you know, ripped from the headlines almost in that regard. And I thought that was pretty amazing, you know. And you mentioned falling forward and, you know, all warfare on some level is a string of miracles propelled by individual moments of sacrifice. And so we see that, you know, it's true on screen and it's true in the real world. And, you know, I would even, there's so much that sort of cascades out of that. There's a reason why every war movie you've ever seen features a squad that's like a collection of oddballs from different locations. Because if you went into the United States Army tomorrow, you would see that it is truly represented and populated by the peoples of the entirety of America. West Point itself actually divvies up slots at the academy proportionally based on members of Congress around the country. So, you know, you're more likely to bump into a kid from California than an Alaskan, because those spots are divvied up by the proportion of the United States. And in this film, we're seeing the same thing. These are a collection of oddballs from sort of, you know, representing different constituencies and people, and they've all come together for some common purpose. So I love that about this film.
Right. John?
Yeah, and that kind of goes into something else I wanted to ask you about, which is the difference in approach between Rogue One and I think most of the rest of Star Wars, especially the episodic stuff, between a focus on, you know, quote unquote heroes, a focus on people who make it into the history books, and a focus on boots on the ground. And for you, you know, does Rogue One ring truer for that?
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of the, you know, in historical circles, they refer to this as the great man theory of history. The idea that
we talk about that a bunch.
Yeah, Thomas Carlyle. You have these titanic figures, but even someone like, so I did my political science dissertation on key moments in major American conflicts, and you know, General Dwight David Eisenhower is an amazing figure, if for no other reason than he never lost sight of perspective. One of the, you know, he had a reporter ask him asking him sort of flowery questions about the D-Day landings and how great his contribution was to the Allied war effort. And, you know, he immediately pivoted the question towards the importance of what was called the Higgins boats, the yeah. flat bottomed boats that were used down in the bayou and in Louisiana, swamp boats, in essence, that they had to bring over to the United Kingdom in order to make the landings. And so he focused on some level, the most prosaic, mundane piece of gear, and how if we didn't have those boats, we wouldn't win. Or there's that iconic image of Eisenhower having a conversation with a paratrooper the day before the landing. It's a guy that's got his face all camoed up. He's wearing a number 23. And it was a kid. He was a second lieutenant from Michigan who wasn't receiving any sort of last minute wisdom from the commanding general. He just found out this kid that day happened to be his 22nd birthday. Uh-huh. And so, you know, when you have someone like Eisenhower who focuses so much of his energy on all those little individual constituent parts, because that's what warfare is. It's a symphony. And while it's important to have a conductor, it's equally important that every individual member is playing in tune. And so I loved that about this film too, you know, because obviously when we're talking about Star Wars, so much focus is on the Jedi and these sort of magical knights.
Space wizards with laser swords. Yeah.
But the reality is, you know, when you take a step back, just as the Death Star isn't the ultimate weapon, neither are the Jedi.
Right.
There is no such, you know, that's the thing. There is no such thing as an ultimate weapon when it comes to war. The Pope, I think it was Pope Innocent II in the 11th or the 12th century, banned crossbows because they were deemed too dangerous and destabilizing. But the reality is war is just this constant one-upmanship. And it just it will go on throughout time forever. Right. And it the same thing happens on screen.
Let's widen our lens out a little bit and think about the Empire as an organization itself,
yeah.
which is trying to bring peace and stability to the galaxy, but doing it in this very heavy-handed,
yeah.
authoritarian way. And we get to see a lot of the inner workings, at least of the ISB in the Andor television show, following Dedra Miro and how she interfaces with, you know, the planetary governor and how he's ordering his troops around, sort of deploying his forces there. But this idea, or then on the Aldani thing, anyway, we could go on from there. The idea of this empire, though, which is such a massive organization, and their strategies for control and tactics. What do you read into how the creators behind the Star Wars universe have constructed this fictional empire?
Yeah, the bureaucracy of evil. You know, there's
right,
the banality of evil and the bureaucracy of evil.
Right.
So, boy, where to begin? There's logic there. I mean, mm-hmm. again, it makes perfect sense. One of the writers in our anthology pointed out, you know, the sort of the Tarkin doctrine. You know, the idea that if you hit hard enough, swift enough, you can cow the entirety of the universe into submission and order and stability. And on some level, at a remove, that makes a lot of sense. You know, there are so many chinks in the Empire's armor. So the rebels have almost this unlimited mobility and movement. They have no, you know, it's easy for them to sort of pick up the organization's mass and move it elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And so on some level, I kind of understand the empire's desire to find an annihilation stroke, you know, because it almost seems as if there's only one rebel left, they can reconstitute the whole thing. They can rebuild the whole tree. They can use one seed to plant the tree. And, you know, at one point we actually do get down to one Jedi, you know,
right.
So you can actually see that played out on screen. That exposes Karl von Clausewitz, who was an early late 18th and early 19th century philosopher of war. His description of a theoretical idealized war. And Clausewitz was such an interesting figure in the sense that he was first on the battlefield at age 12 and fought through all of his even pre-adolescent life through his adult life. And much of that was spent losing to Napoleon, which forced this sense he ultimately didn't die on the battlefield, by the way. He died of cholera.
Right.
But he, you know, reflected on what the difference was between a winning side and a losing side. And he theorized this idea, idealized war, which is, you can kind of shorthand it like this. It's the single haymaker theory of warfare. You build one giant weapon that takes all of your energies or kyber crystals. You blow up all of your adversaries in one immense blast, and all is perfect and achieved and wonderful with the world. But of course, so he used that as a foil, thesis, antithesis, synthesis. In the real world, the antithesis is, we have constant frictions tugging at us. You know, all three of us on this call have children. We know what that is. We can never achieve some idealized state of life. And the same thing is true of warfare. In the real world, it's a nuclear weapon, right? Vladimir Putin in his dreams may want to create some super mega weapon that instantly kills all his opposition on the battlefield in Ukraine, for example. Ain't going to happen. Someone is going to defect and tell the Ukrainians about the super weapon. The super weapon won't fire as intended. You name it. You can add all, you can pick it apart. Death by a thousand pinpricks. Mm-hmm. We see that on screen. In the film, while the Empire wants this super weapon that cows all opposition into submission, it doesn't even happen in the fictitious world because it doesn't jive with reality. It has to be tethered to reality in some way.
There's a great scene in the Andor where Luthen is asking Cassian, how do you get in? And he's like, they're so arrogant that they can't even believe a guy like me would just walk in. I just have to look the part. And because their mind is so drawn out to these bigger things that, like you said, the defector, the parts manufacturer, the supply chain, the break in the supply chain are all going to lead inevitably to some sort of things not working the way you envisioned them.
Yeah. So for the Empire, annihilation is sort of preferred, and attritional warfare is difficult for them because, you know, not everybody wants to sign up. Whereas on the flip side, the rebellion seems as though attrition is more possible. And what I mean by that is you can see that them able to win over converts and defectors. And of course we get that in our pilot, that defects, and we get that in Galen Erso.
Right.
We get these defectors. And so that actually seems achievable or an objective for the rebellion in this particular case. I'm sorry, I stepped on John, I think.
No worries. It's great context to add. You know, I wanted to, you know, bring in the way that the Empire sort of treats the people working for it. You know, these people who give their whole life to the Empire. You know, you can put to the obvious Galen Erso. You know, they killed his wife in front of him and tried to kill his daughter. And that clearly radicalized him from within. But you also have Krennic, and Krennic being refused credit for his work on the Death Star, causing his sloppiness, which left an opening for the rebels. And so it's interesting to contrast that with Cassian Andor shooting someone who he thought would get him caught at the beginning of the movie, right? Is both of these sides are treating people as disposable in some way.
Yeah.
But Cassian is doing it for the cause of the rebellion so that, you know, plans aren't taken, so that nobody finds out that they know about the Death Star weakness, or rather that nobody knows about the pilot. And then the Empire is doing it for Tarkin's ego, right? And for Krennic's ego. So yeah, it's super interesting to contrast that.
I mean, if you want to win converts and on some level that is, Sun Tzu is the most quoted text on strategy in the world because it's basically sort of the buy low, sell high, advice, to be doled out for winning on the battlefield. But, Sun Tzu, which was probably a compilation of many writers, but points out that the acme of skill, the best you could imagine is to simply, for your opponents to dissolve and then join your forces. And if you are cruelly and wantonly disregarding or disposing of either members of your side or the opponent's side, you know, you're not going to win a lot of converts. The other thing that I would add to that, though, is, warfare is the part of social activity where human beings are truly disposable. And that is an ugly idea, but it is true when it comes to modern war. I mean, that's, that on some level, that's the point. So I served for a year in South Korea and north of Seoul, basically on the DMZ. And, you know, cynics have pointed out that the American military presence in South Korea is basically a human tripwire. And by that, what I mean is the North Koreans would be less inclined to fire upon South Korea because doing so would mean killing Americans and drawing the Americans into the war. So on some level, I'm just sort of a part of a human shield in my service in South Korea. And I, you know, is that what I like? Is that the good night story that I tell my kids, before I go there? No. But when I get down to it, that is one of the functions that I served while I was in Korea. So, yeah.
I was thinking of when the Empire sacrifices the facility on Scarif, mm-hmm. that they're willing, whatever Tarkin's big picture that he has, he's like, we can lose this base. That is, we can destroy it ourselves to cauterize, whatever's going on here. And to me, that's just unbelievable. I just cannot understand the level of that decision making. Because granted, there's probably some other backup locations that have all of these plans and all these kinds of things, but you're intentionally harming your own ability by taking this facility out. But yet that is the willing, that he's willing to go there. He's willing to do that. That is just phenomenal to me.
It's hard to watch. And it's actually, there's echoes of that decision in a more, I would say, ethical light. Mm-hmm. So 10 years ago, the Israeli Defense Force had a second lieutenant. I think his name was Second Lieutenant Goldeen, who was taken taken prisoner by Hamas into the tunnels. And they actually
this
had
is
developed
pre the current. This is
This is a decade ago. Okay. And I remember just like my jaw dropping, even as a military person, that the Israeli Defense Force had developed what they call the Samson Doctrine, where if one of their military members, these are people in uniform. These are not civilians.
Right.
If one of their military members is taken and believed to be alive by an adversary like Hamas, the battle drill response was to call artillery fire on the last known location on the theory that it is better for that soldier to perish than A, be taken hostage, and then B, the Israeli Defense Force to have to go and put more lives at risk to get that soldier back.
Right.
And if you, I think if you look it up, I think they eventually did have to trade, I think it was 1,000 Palestinian prisoners slash Hamas prisoners in order to get them back. Now, of course, I don't want to turn this conversation happening in Gaza right now.
Right, yeah.
'Cause you know what I said before, fiction is, it's not an escape from reality, but it animates reality. In this moment, I want to escape from reality because it's awful all around.
Yeah.
But what I'm pointing out is, in that same scenario that Krennic finds himself in, right? There are variants of it where I think it makes sense to actually fire upon people wearing the same uniform.
Right.
However, that's not one of them. You know, that's not one of them that exactly warms the heart.
Well, and then I just thinking about this even further, that's got to be counter motivational to your own people to know, like, wait a minute, we're going to get nuked by our own boss. Like,
correct.
Why would I want to wear this uniform anymore?
So you'll find that so many of us, you know, I joined the Army because it was a way for me to go to school at West Point. Mm-hmm. I wanted to play hockey, you know, and, I it's not as if I was born on the 4th of July where I had, you know, I'm Lieutenant Dan where all of my family members are in the military. And what you'll find is by and large, if you went into an army, a squad, platoon or battalion right now, or in any of the other services, you know, you're not going to find like, you know, gung ho types. A lot of them are there because they're looking to pay for college or get a job, or it was my ticket to getting out of Nowheresville. However, what I will say is that over time, you do, those values sort of permeate you. But at no point does your belief in your cause ever overwhelm your awareness of your leadership's judicious decision making in how to spend your life. And what I mean is, like, as I pointed out at the beginning, you know, we're trading human lives to advance some objective. That part I understood and I saluted and I accepted. I just don't want to be spent for a shitty objective, you know, it better mean something. If my kids have to just get a flag and that's all they get left to me, there had better been some really amazing reason for that to happen. Now, let's take it into Rogue One. You know, spending Cassian Andor, spending, you know, he's a captain, right? He's a spending a captain, spending Jyn Erso, spending K2SO, that was worth it, right? Like that, you know, that achieving, seizing the plans for the Death Star, absolutely worth it. You know, so this is fiction, but it rings true.
Right.
Right. And I think it would have been a very different conversation had they gone with their almost plan to have them survive at the end. Because you can see they're basically at peace at the end when they when they're waiting for the sunrise and whatnot. And I want to talk about Luthen for a minute, because I think Luthen is one of the coolest characters introduced to Star Wars in a while. Luthen from Andor, who talks about sort of burning his soul for the sake of the rebellion. And, you know, we've talked a lot about, you know, sacrificing human lives for a cause, but not a lot yet about sacrificing sort of who we are and sacrificing, you know, our quote unquote souls, whatever that means to you. Have you, is this something that you sort of consider in your work?
I mean, I think that that's the hardest part about all of this, because, you know, the military is granted, the military is a profession, you know, like I'll start there. Just as, doctors, and lawyers are members of a profession. You know, the sick want to be healed. The accused want a just trial, and a society requires a defense, you know? And I think, you know, right now at this very moment, there are a number of different societies in Ukraine and Israel and in Palestine, you know, in the Gaza Strip, that feel that need for a defense. And so members of that profession have an obligation to take very seriously what things they are willing to do and what things they will not do in order to defend society. There's an old phrase, you know, the military's purpose is to kill people and break things. No, it's not. You know, killing people and breaking things is, first of all, it's not even a purpose. That's a task. That's a physical thing that you might do. The military's purpose is to defend some society. You know, my oath was to uphold the Constitution and to protect and defend Americans and American soil and American interests. And, you know, one of the most constant themes that you have in the military profession is someone's individual conscience versus what the society is asking that individual to do. And there's no easy answers. It's always a give and play and a tug, right? The world was treated to Oppenheimer. You know, the film about J. Robert Oppenheimer and his development of the atomic weapon, you know, in some ways, the Death Star of the 1940s. And then his anger and sadness and regret over what sort of awfulness they had on, you know, put upon the earth. There's no way to get around it. The nuclear weapon use in Japan instantly killed non-combatants, women and children and old people, civilians. You have to balance that, though, against the suffering that the Japanese Empire was visiting upon the peoples of the Pacific. You know, that also is awful. And I know that, I mean, this is, someone's going to come back and record this phrase that I'm going to use, and it'll come back to haunt me maybe someday. But sometimes two wrongs does get us to a right. Mm. And the use of the atomic weapon, the nuclear weapon, was ugly and abhorrent, but it did help to end one of the worst spells of humanity, you know, that humanity has ever moved through. So
the apex of mechanized warfare was in the Pacific and in Europe and it was going to keep grinding on.
So I'm not giving any, John, you pose a wonderful question. The reason that my answer is meandering is because there is no sort of simple,
There's no simple clean answer.
Yeah, there's no clean answer. You know, it's these issues just will continue to happen over and over and over again. And the one thing I will say, the one thing that I would like commit to is that as a member of the military profession, the obligation that we have is to use all of the ethical reasoning that's built into our profession, mm-hmm. and then lay bare those choices to the civilians that direct us and guide us. Because when you get down to it, the military's purpose, as I mentioned, is to protect and defend civilians, but it is at the direction of the civilians. It is at the direction of the civilian leadership.
Whereas in the empire, it's at the direction is the empire.
It's the other way around.
Yeah. And we're imposing peace and stability as opposed to forming a sociological structure in which society can have tools at its disposal to protect itself or to do things. Because you can think of uniformed service too, not just fighting arms, but uniform service in terms of natural disaster, in terms of, you know, of all threat response, right? Of all kinds of different things. So,
which are growing.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's not just that. And I think you put your finger on the fact that war is tragic and unclean, and it sullies everyone. And we now start to talk about the moral harms that warfare has on individuals.
Yeah,
the things that you carry home. And I think we see that with Cassian as a rebel, as a captain in a rebellious army. He's saying, I have done things that are, you know, just unspeakable. And if I can't believe that I did something, that all these things that I did were not in service of a greater good, then I couldn't live with myself.
Yes.
And he ultimately pays the full price for that, right?
Absolutely.
Because he dies on the beach there.
You know, you raised Luthen and Cassian, both of them. So that's sort of the pointy end of the spear, right?
Mm.
But the other thing that comes out in Rogue One is warfare's cost to society. So the very first thing that we see in the film is a child running away from war. And of course, part of that first opening sequence is taking a scientist to develop military technology.
So Oppenheimer-like.
There's a joke that I heard that that in the Second World War, our German scientists, you know, our German Jewish scientists beat their German Jewish scientists, and you know these are the scientists that fled Germany before the war, and of course after the war. In Operation Paperclip, welcomed them into the United States. But even, you know, after that, in the early 1950s, you get first General Eisenhower, now President Eisenhower, giving what's called his chance for peace speech. Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, who are cold and not clothed. Wow. You know, the world at in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists. And I pulled that off, lifted that, knowing we might bump into it, because think of all the effort and the bureaucracy of evil that we see, right? You know, in completing the Death Star and in the Andor series, think of how you might do a little jujitsu and redirect those to humanitarian aims.
Right.
You know, it's the old guns versus butter discussion.
Right.
And like when I'm watching that, even as a member of the military, right, I recognize that there is some irreducible minimum that we do need, you know, we need to put good weapons in the hands of young people that we ask to join the service. However, every dollar that we spend that is unnecessary towards securing national defense is, of course, money that could be used to better ends. And I, like so many of us, you know, wearing the uniform can see that.
Well, that was there's so many, I feel like John and I have this joke that we're like, oh, we can get this podcast done in an hour. And I think we're going to try and actually hold ourselves on this account because you're here with us. But I feel like this could go on for quite a much longer, and we could span out into so many questions. I have a dozen unanswered sort of, you know, topics that we could dive into. But I think your quote there about the cost of warfare, the true cost of warfare to a society is a good note to end on. And I think that's the idea. I think that's one of the things that really makes Andor and Rogue One so enthralling. It's consistently people's favorites, is because it is real in that sense that it forces us to examine the costs. Like you said, you know, trading lives for objectives, or what is the true cost of war, or in the Empire's calculation, what's the true cost of peace, an imposed peace as opposed to a organic peace, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot there. So it's been great having a conversation with you. Just really quick, what are three different pieces of media that you're consuming right now? What are shows, movies, books, anything you're listening to that, you know, folks might find interesting or that you've recently watched or whatever?
Oh gosh. Last night I watched the first episode of the Mr. and Mrs. Smith series.
So good, isn't it?
It's actually like it's not overblown. I'm super impressed. This one is a podcast. The Rest is History. It's two British historians walking you through. Now I know that's not fiction.
Any pieces of media.
And then the third one is actually like, no joke, you mentioned a sister podcast or an adjacent podcast that I did not so long ago on Game of Thrones. And I actually happened to be reading back through George R. R. Martin's books, you know, just because, you know, I needed an airplane book, and they're always fantastic. And so I'm actually still working my way back through Martin's set. So yeah, those three.
Great. Okay. Well, Matt, thank you so much for spending some time with us. I hope we could have you back on again in the future. There's a lot that we could talk about. John, any parting thoughts?
Yeah, I really appreciate that Eisenhower quote to end. You have me thinking now, and I want to prepare myself for the next time we talk to you. I think it'd be good to talk to you around, you know, when we hit episode 9, where we talk about the New Republic a little bit more. Because I'm thinking about how, you know, in the Ahsoka series, I don't know if you caught that yet, but, you know, when the New Republic Senate is just like, no, you're not taking all these resources and going to hunt for this threat we don't know is there. And we, you know, there is a balance, right? There's a balance between overcautiousness and overzealousness.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Matt, folks can find your books online, you know, from a shop, Winning Westeros and Strategy Strikes Back.
Yep.
Great. Thanks again for taking the time, and we look forward to chatting with you again in the future.
Thanks so much, guys. A lot of fun.
So David, we're just going to do a quick outro here. I think this is, you know, this is kind of a bonus episode. So let's just talk quickly about what we're doing right now. We have, of course, two other affiliates on our network. We've got We'll Shift Dust with Alicia. A little bit of a hiatus right now, but she'll be back. I know you're working on something with the Oscars with her, so stay tuned on that feed. Properly Howard Movie Review is also on a break, but we will be covering Severance with them later in the year. As for us, you can check out our weekly coverage of True Detective coming out just after the episode airs, thanks to Screeners. Every single week, you can get the Detective's Notebook that David puts together. If you
as
are
a Patreon subscriber benefit, yep.
Mm-hmm. Brandon and I are finally reconvening to do another Lorehounds play on Final Fantasy VII Remake. That's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be ahead of the sequel to it, Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, because they want to confuse it with all these renames. That's coming out on Leap Day. David, you and I are going to keep going through the Star Wars universe with A New Hope later in February or perhaps early March. We're going to talk about timing with that, but definitely right in with questions and comments on Star Wars 1977, whatever you want to call it. Call it whatever you want. I know there's a generational divide there. Don't forget, we're bringing back Earthsea this month. We're going to be reading Dragonfly and Chapter 1 of The Other Wind with Marilyn R. Pukula, our favorite Tolkien and Le Guin scholar. Silmarillion Stories are back with Of Men, a chapter. It's just called Of Men. We're going for it. We're talking about all of those crazy guys in Middle Earth in the First Age. Finally, you and Brandon, David, are doing coverage of Masters of the Air. You did one already on the first two episodes, and you'll be doing a wrap-up at the end. I know you just mentioned to Matt that you might have him back on for something at the end of the season.
Yeah, that might be fun. I know we're going to have a special guest for our wrap-up podcast, and then maybe we'll do another one of these podcasts at the end where, a whole separate standalone interview where we can talk a little bit about what we saw and contextualizing it a little bit more. That would be fun.
Very cool. All right. One other note, MC Universe is back this month with a preview of Madame Web.
Correct. And we're trying to figure out how our coverage is going to go because of availability in the theaters and recording schedules. We're either going to do a short preview and then a follow-up review once it's out, or we'll do it combined depending on how quickly we can get to it. The part of the issue for me is in my local theater, I don't know if we're going to get it on that first weekend. Sometimes we get movies a little delayed, so we'll see.
All right. Well, we'll keep you posted on anything else we might cover. We have a few things on the consideration block. Yes. For now, David, can you give a big thank you to our Patreon lore masters?
I would love to. I would love to say thank you to Samartian, Mark H., Michael G., Michelle E., David W., Brian P., Nick W., SC, Peter OH, Bettina W., Adam S., Nancy M., Duve 71, Brian 8063, Frederick H., Sarah L., Gareth C., Eric F., Matthew M., Sarah M., DJ Miwa, Andra B., Kwong Yu, Deadeye Jedi Bob, Nathan T., Alex V., Aaron T., Sub-Zero, Aaron K., Dally V21, Gnarls, and the last, who shall be first, Adrian. Thank you all so very much. Good old Gnarls. Thank you all so very much for all your support. It keeps us moving and keeps the whole... Yeah, just it keeps
the Death Star building.
There you go. I was flailing for a metaphor.
That's all right. David, we had a great conversation. We learned so much that our brains aren't working anymore. So that's may right. I just say, let the Force be with you.
And also with you.
The Lorehounds podcast is produced and published by The Lorehounds. You can send questions and feedback and voicemails at thelorehounds.com/contact. Get early and ad-free access to all Lorehounds podcasts at patreon.com/thelorehounds and connect with us on Twitter at @thelorehounds. Any opinions stated are ours personally and do not reflect the opinion of or belong to any employers or other entities. Thanks for listening.
Lord Vader, Operation Andor is underway.
Excellent. If we release 3 episodes per week, the Lorehounds will never be able to cover every episode. The Imperial forces will crush the rebellion before it begins.
Stand by. We're picking up something on our scanners.
Echo Squadron, reporting in.
Delta Squadron, on your left.
Django Squadron, on your 6.
With Imperial forces coming in fast, we're calling all Rebels to join the fight this season. Starting after the April 22nd premiere, you'll hear 3 full breakdowns for each week's episodes of Andor Season 2. Each podcast will be led by one of our squadron leaders, Alicia, David, and John. We'll be bringing in new and familiar voices to fill out the roster. Search for the Lorehounds on any podcast platform to join us in a galaxy far, far away. And don't forget to check out our season pass for even more content like our Holocron bonus pods. It's good news for anyone, except Darth Vader.